And we will continue to be in John chapters 9 and 10 together this morning. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. This was one of my favorite passages to use when I was a Young Life leader and when I was giving club talks on a regular basis. Right? I mean, how fun is it to try to convince teenagers that in a world that is offering them so many different answers about where they can find life, about what will truly satisfy them, that Jesus has come to offer them real life, abundant life. Sometimes Jesus calls on the phone. I loved telling teenagers that in Jesus, they could find their truest selves, right? As they're at school and they're trying to figure out who they are, that in Jesus, they could figure that out. That in Jesus, they could find an unconditional acceptance by the God who created them, right? In a season where they're wondering, where do I belong? And they're trying to fit in anywhere. And that in Jesus, they could discover the fullest and most overflowing life that they could imagine. I mean, you could see how fun this would be to share this with teenagers on a regular basis. And occasionally I would contrast this life, the abundance of life with Jesus, with the works of the thief who comes to steal and kill and destroy. Not quite as fun of a message, but an important part of our passage this morning. Chapter 10, Jesus describes the thief. And he describes this thief who climbs into the sheep pen by some other way than the door, right? The thief is sneaky. And this thief is a stranger who cannot lead the sheep out of the pen because the sheep won't follow the thief out. And so the thief has to rely on another strategy. Steal from the sheep, kill the sheep, or destroy the sheep. And so the question for us this morning, as we've heard this passage, is who or what is this thief then? And Jesus tells us that all who came before me are thieves and robbers. And so the thief is a person. Or the thieves are many people. Right? The thieves are those who sought to steal, kill, and destroy God's people. In the Gospel of John, these thieves are identified primarily as the Pharisees and the various religious leaders. So that as Jesus starts talking about thieves and shepherds, he's actually talking to some Pharisees. That this is a conversation that they've initiated. And in verse 6, chapter 10, verse 6, we learn this figure of speech, right? Thieves and shepherds that Jesus has used with them, they did not understand what he was saying to them. In other words, right, this is one of those great moments in John's gospel where Jesus identifies, he calls out these leaders he's talking to as thieves who are trying to do real damage to God's people. He calls them out specifically because of what they've been doing in chapter 9, and they have no idea. They don't understand what he's saying. And chapter 9 is one of probably like the all-time classic stories about Jesus and his power to heal. Right, like Jesus walks up to this blind man, and then, not just any blind man, a man born blind, which according to Jewish tradition was a man who could not be healed. And so Jesus spits on the ground, makes a little bit of mud, swipes it on the guy's eyes, and then sends him to a pool to get cleansed or something. Like, we're like not really sure how this is all supposed to work. Like, what's the purpose of the mud and the spit? There had to have been other ways to make mud, right? What is Jesus up to? But it's memorable. Like, is there any healing as memorable as this one? I mean, for years, our daughter Becca would play outside and say that she was making mud like Jesus did for the blind man, right? Jesus tells this man to go and wash in the pool of Siloam. So the man went and he washed and he came back seeing. And by this point, Jesus is gone. He's disappeared. As people ask this man what had happened, he gives a quick summary, a pretty succinct one, right? I was blind and now I see. Short, sweet, to the point. Jesus has given new life to this man. In a world that didn't have things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, right? This man had no options in his world. Like this man was a man who was not valued by his society. And Jesus has come and given him new life. I mean, society viewed this man as somebody who had nothing to offer. The best that a man born blind could hope for in life was a life of begging, right? I mean, could you imagine if you thought that this was the sole purpose of your life, to sit alongside a road and to hope that people pitied you enough to give you a bit of charity? And now Jesus has given this man more than just sight. Jesus has given this place, this man, a place in society. He no longer has to sit by the road. He now can see and can function as a full member of the community. Jesus has done infinitely more for this man than just heal his sight. More than that, this man has been given another kind of sight. He suddenly knows the truth that the God of life has come and has met him face to face and healed him. This man recognizes that the God of life is looking at him, is standing there staring at him in Jesus. And in verse 38, the man confesses his trust in Jesus, and we're told that he worships him. This man knows what's going on. What an incredible story that Jesus, right, might come and want to meet with you and make you part of his people and give you sight so that you might worship him. What's crazy about this is that that's just like one piece of the story. That's a huge piece. It's a good piece, but it's only a piece of it. See, chapter 9 is about more than just a showcase for Jesus and Jesus's power, but it's actually a showdown for Jesus, this life-giving shepherd, and the Pharisees, the life-stealing thieves. See, the Pharisees are busy working to take life. Jesus powerfully gives it. And so just to make maybe the immediate connection for us this morning, before we take a deeper look at these Pharisees, here's why this matters for us. Like, there are, if we're honest, Pharisee-like thieves in our lives who will try to keep us from seeing Jesus, who will try to keep us from believing that the Good Shepherd has come near to us and wants to give us life. These Pharisee-like thieves will not stop at anything to keep us from worshiping Jesus and from following him with our lives. In John 9, we learn that these thieves have a clear strategy. And part of what John is training us in is understanding it so that we can overcome it. But truthfully, I don't want to spend the morning beating up on the Pharisees, because there's actually a more subtle danger in our passage. See, the Pharisees at this point have actually been around for a while. They've been pretty influential for some time now. And this means that their teaching, their worldview, their attitudes, their way of looking at their neighbors have made their way into the larger culture. And so the Pharisees, as these fairly effective leaders in their time, have shaped the culture they live in. So that whether the Pharisees are present or not in any given scene, the spirit of the Pharisees is at work in powerful ways. And I think this is also relevant for us, because culture is often like water for fish, right? We swim in our culture every single day so that we don't even know it's there. We just sort of take it for granted. And if you do notice that you're in water, like, what can you say about it? It's just water. It's always been there. So much so that it just feels normal, seems normal. And you could occasionally sort of cherry pick some of water's obvious excesses, right? You can recognize that there's some things not quite right in your culture, maybe some big behaviors that stand out as wrong or as inappropriate or as harmful. But for the most part, attitudes and mindsets and worldviews, ideologies, these are often a part of us in ways that we just can't see, because we are a product of our culture in so many ways. And so one of the great dangers is that the thieves would change the way that we think about the world so that we begin to treat our neighbors the way that the thieves do. We see this in our passage. We see this in the disciples. At the beginning, the very beginning of our passage, chapter 9. See, they ask a question about this man born blind, and it's a strange question, right? It's not a question we ever hear Jesus asking, right? It doesn't in any way resonate with the vision that we see in Jesus. But what we discover is that the disciples are asking a question that they learned to ask from the Pharisees. So chapter 9, verse 1, we read, "As Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, 'Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?' And Jesus answered, 'It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him.'" Jesus sees a man, and his disciples are right there with him. But what or who do they see? See, the disciples come to this man, and their first question is about his sin. They think about this man in terms of sin. When we think about people in terms of their sin, we're often looking for someone, something to blame. They want a reason for this man's embarrassing condition. To be born blind was an embarrassment. It was a shame. This person had no value. Something went wrong, and they're trying to uncover that. And even though they're willing to look at this man and go, maybe it wasn't you, maybe it was your parents, it's still sin that they're obsessed with. It's sin that holds their focus. Who is it that sinned? What could they have done, you have done, that was bad enough to deserve this lot in life? Maybe you've heard the question, what did I do to deserve this? It reflects this spirit. How many of us know the feeling of at some point in our life being seen as our sin? Right, where somebody looks at you and they see you or they label you based on your sin. Or maybe it's not quite so blatant, right? It's rarely quite that blatant. Like maybe your sin isn't so visible. Like you don't wear it on your sleeves, right? All then that can be seen in your life is misfortune. Or maybe your life is marked by a series of tragedies or hardships. And so maybe people look at you and they pity you. And so they don't ask you to your face, but they wonder. And maybe they talk about it to the side. Man, what'd you do to deserve this? Who sinned to cause you to suffer like this? Jesus, however, looks at this man and he sees something very different. He doesn't say this man is without sin, and he doesn't free the man's parents from probably having sin. But Jesus looks at this man's condition and he has no interest in talking about sin. Jesus wants to talk about the Father. The only sin Jesus wants to talk about in this passage is the Pharisees' sin. When they claim that they can see that they are without sin, Jesus just wants to make sure that they know that they're still in their sin. And then he moves on. See, for Jesus, sin is a given. And so the question isn't like, is there sin? Who did it? How bad was it? The question for Jesus is, what is God doing about it? Like the disciples want to know, are we looking at a victim here or are we looking at the criminal? Right? For them, that's how you know whether you should help someone. Right? Do they deserve it? Are they a victim or are they the criminal? But Jesus just sees somebody that is loved by God. And Jesus sees somebody who God can show off his incredible works through. The disciples focus on human failure and human weakness, but Jesus focuses on God's mercy and God's desire to draw near to sinners. The disciples focus on what the Pharisees have trained them to look at, which is sin. Because your sin determines where you belong in the community. It determines whether you belong at all in the community. Jesus wants to give his disciples a new vision, a new sight. He wants them to see the Father, because if they see the Father, they will understand that they belong. And we hear this as Jesus talks with the man a little bit later. See, after Jesus has given him sight and after the man is put through a series of conversations, Jesus and him have this face-to-face. In chapter 9, verse 35, the man has been kicked out of the synagogue, the very synagogue that he just was welcomed into as he regained his sight. So that's a bummer, right? But in verse 35, we hear them have this conversation. Jesus heard that they had cast this man out. And so he found him and said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus says, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." Sometimes I like to just hear Jesus saying stuff in weird tones, but right, like, it's he who's speaking to you. Like, that would be a weird thing, but hearing him say it with a little funny thing on the end makes it enjoyable. Welcome to my brain. Sorry about that. Tom has warned me about sharing too much. It is he who is speaking to you. And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped Jesus. Can you see the work of God displayed in this man? Like, yes, God clearly gave the man his physical sight. Like, he can see now. He can walk around without any assistance. But the father is able to help this man see something far more important. The father has enabled this man to see Jesus for who he is, someone who can be trusted, as someone deserving of worship. And this man in this moment truly can see. This is a mighty work of God. In fact, the man can see in a way that, if we think about it, even a blind person could see. Right? And think about the way that most of us practice prayer in our lives. What do you do with your eyes? We close them. Mostly. Not everyone and not all the time, right? But why? Because none of us are looking for Jesus to show up physically in our midst. We're not expecting that when we pray. But there is this sense that when we pray, we are seeing Jesus for who he is, and that doesn't require our eyes. It doesn't require our eyeballs to see that Jesus is the life-giving good shepherd. And this is really great news for us who don't get to see Jesus with our physical eyes in this life, that God can give us true and real spiritual insight to see Jesus and to trust him, that he is this good and life-giving shepherd that we can give our lives over to. And this is the problem with the Pharisees, right? The Pharisees, they cannot see. They are blind. They are blinded by sin. The man tries to explain to these Pharisees what Jesus has done. And in verse 34, all they can say is, "You're a sinner. You were born in sin. What could you teach us?" They're obsessed with sin. They dismiss him because of the sin that they think they see, and they cast him out, and they kick him out of the community that Jesus just restored him to. The Pharisees, they cannot see people. All they can see is sin. All they can see is human failure. All they can see is human weakness. The focus for the Pharisees is on what people have done wrong. And the focus for Jesus is always the Father and what he has done right, or what he could do right, or what he will do right. And this begins then with seeing the beauty of people. Right? Men and women, boys and girls made by God in the image of God, made to bear his light. If you follow the Pharisees through this passage, you will see their inability to see people as good, as the good handiwork of God. They are obsessed with sin. It's all they can see. So in chapter 9, verse 16, the blind man is brought to the Pharisees. And we hear some of the Pharisees said, "This man, Jesus, is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "Well, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was this division among them. This group of Pharisees are divided over Jesus, right? Some are convinced he cannot be from God because of the way that he has sinned against the Sabbath by making mud and by, you know, opening the eyes of a man on the day of rest. This is sin. And therefore, he cannot be from God. And this is what I love here. There's a division between among the Pharisees, that this other group of Pharisees think, well, Jesus probably didn't sin. He couldn't have sinned. This was an act too great to have been done by somebody who sinned. But notice what they're debating. Sin. The focus is still on sin, right? Did he or didn't he? Nobody is talking about the ridiculous thing that God has just done, which is give sight to a man born blind. All they can do is discuss whether Jesus broke a rule and what they should do about him. And then in verse 21, the Pharisees have moved on from the man, and they're talking with the parents of the man who can now see. And the parents are interesting, right? Because they don't want to say the wrong thing. And so they tell the Pharisees, go talk to our son instead. Verse 22 gives us a little bit of insight as to why these parents were so nervous. See, the Pharisees have made a rule. Of course they did. People obsessed with sin make lots of rules. To say anything too lofty about Jesus is to commit a sin against God and the community, and so it's cause for being kicked out of the synagogue. True or not, the Pharisees decide what sin is great enough to cast you out. And the Pharisees create fear among God's people over whether they will be in or out. Whether they will be in or out. Let me suggest to you that if you are looking for thieves, anybody who is actively attempting to create fear as to whether you belong in or out, may be busy thieving. Verse 24, the Pharisees call the man back and they have more to say about sin. Give glory to God, they say. We know that this man is a sinner, talking about Jesus. This is amazing, right? They speak about God and his glory. And in the same breath, they speak about sin as though these two things are like closely related, right? Like they imagine that by calling out Jesus and his clear sinfulness, like God is glorified in this. When people are sin obsessed, they tend to think that God is sin obsessed as well. So how do you glorify God? Well, you call out sin by pointing it out and you make sure sin is on the table and everybody knows it's there. But of course the blind man, he sees, and so he knows better. And I can't tell you how important this is in this passage, that God is not glorified by us when we focus on human sin. God gets honor. God's beauty is seen through his work, not ours. Sure, God's great and mighty works are about his ability to overcome human sin, to restore things that have been destroyed by human sin, and to set sinners free from their slavery to sin. But the way that John tells this story, we understand that sin is like the man's blindness. The man's blindness really isn't the focus. It's not the main attraction, right? Because it's God who is. And so when we focus on sin, we lose sight of what God can do and wants to do, so that sin, like blindness, is merely an opportunity for the works of God to be displayed. The man born blind, he gets this. So that like when he's questioned, he says this in verse 25. He says, whether he's a sinner, I do not know. One thing I know, though I was blind, now I see. I love this line so much. Right, on the surface, the man is telling us his straightforward truth. Previously, he could not physically see. Jesus then did something to him, and now he can. But this man is at the same time revealing this deeper work of God, so that when the man says, whether Jesus is a sinner or not, I do not know, he's actually echoing Jesus from earlier. Remember what Jesus said when the disciples first asked about this man and his parents' sin? Jesus says, basically, it doesn't matter. It was not that this man sinned or his parents. I just lost myself, my place on my page. The man sees how Jesus sees. His focus isn't on the sin of the man, but where is his focus? But it is on the works of God displayed in a man. The man who can see with his eyes, but he can also see with spiritual eyes, that God has done something through Jesus, and this man can now see it, while the Pharisees cannot. And so this man's focus on God takes sin and it moves it away from center stage so that God can be the star of the show. The thief is the one who comes to steal and kill and destroy. But the one who is the good shepherd takes center stage. And this is what this means. The thief is the person or the people who come along and tell the man who was born blind that he has no value or worth in the world. Who come along and tell this man that his condition disqualifies him or his sin disqualifies him from being accepted by the Father. The thieves have seen this blind man and they have seen only in him his sin and his shame. And they have defined this man not by what God has done, who God has made, but by what he can or cannot do on his own. This man, one of the sheep in God's flock, has been lied to his entire life. Now, Jesus says in chapter 10 that no one will snatch his sheep out of his hand. And so we accept that these thieves could not actually steal the sheep from Jesus. Right? There's no way thieves can somehow get in and pull sheep out of the hand of God. But they could steal the truth from him. They could convince him that his sin disqualified him from God's love. They could destroy his life by convincing him that he was an outsider outside the flock while he was actually inside the entire time. And we know this, right? That those who feel that they don't belong somewhere will often choose to live as outsiders, the outsiders they feel they are. So that right there in the care of the shepherd, this man could have resisted and could have lived in destructive ways. And we find among God's people that this was often the case. As we think about this, what it means to be counted among God's people and yet seduced or lured into believing that somehow we're out, that something disqualifies us. I've got two bits of application for us this morning of how to respond, how to live in light of this. I've got something for disciples of Jesus who don't realize they've been shaped by the Pharisees' obsession with sin. And I've got something for those of you who have been the target of sin seekers. First, for the disciples of Jesus, it's important that we remember, before humans sinned, we were made to bear God's glorious image. That God looked at what he had made and he called it good. And the shepherd loves his sinful sheep enough to lay down his life for them before they ever turn from their sin. Paul says it this way, while we were still enemies, Christ died for us. If you cannot talk about people without talking about the ways that they've wronged you, the things that they have done wrong, the problems that they have, the ways that they don't fit in or belong, fill in the blank. If you can't talk about people, all people, the real test is the way you talk about your enemies. If you can't talk about them in ways that give them dignity, and that persuasively communicate that they are loved not only by the Father, but by you. You are blind. and still in your sin. And the Good Shepherd is inviting you to come and to have your eyes opened by him so that you might see the way that he does. The good news for you is that the good news is available for everyone. Whether you are a man born blind or a thief or a robber, there is no sheep in the shepherd's pen that is without sin. Sin is a given. And so sin doesn't determine whether you are in or whether you are out. And then to those of you who have constantly been identified with your sin, my prayer for you is that you would hear the voice of your good shepherd this morning. That you would hear from him that he wants you to see. He wants you to see and trust his truth, which is this, that you are beloved. That your sin is not too great for God to overcome. In fact, this is his specialty. That he adores you. And most important, that he lays down his life for you. And so your sin has been dealt with, friends. So get over it. And as you see what Jesus has done for you with your new eyes, worship him. Draw close to him. Follow him. Jesus brings new life to blind eyes. And he brings new life. He's promised to bring new life to dead bodies. Today, his promise is that he can bring abundant life here and now to those of us who have not really been living. And so I invite you this morning to come to the table, a table where Jesus wants to feed you with a reminder of how far he's willing to go for you, a table that reminds us that he has offered us new life. And so every time we eat the bread and we drink the cup, we remember our good shepherd who invites us to walk with him and know him. I invite our servers to come.